Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a TrueCash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate TrueCash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade-in for your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
We talk a lot on this podcast about just getting up and doing it. Grabbing a camera, writing a script, partnering with people you think are talented, finding a piece of IP, and just going out and making shit happen. My next guest, I think, is the champion of that. It's Adam Carolla, who is a best-selling author. He's a radio personality, a television personality. He's an actor, a comedian. He has a record-setting podcast that has millions of listeners and millions of downloads. And he is a guy who, throughout his entire career, has just gone out and done it himself. From the moment he started in radio to calling into shows to figuring out how to break in the most unconventional way possible by meeting Jimmy Kimmel and teaching him how to box through becoming a radio personality, one of the most popular here in Los Angeles on the local radio station called KROQ, to creating characters, to then going to radio on in his own right, going through comedy and stand-up. This guy has done it all and has just done it his way. He's a very specific guy and he knows what makes him laugh and he knows what he's interested in and he has followed that vision all the way through his career, and it has paid off massively. So for anybody who's listening out there who just thinks that you got to know somebody or you have to go through the traditional studio system or you have to go through an agency or have to do it one way, I hope this podcast inspires you to realize there are many, many, many ways to get into the business and to follow your dreams and, in the case of Adam Carolla, become a massive, massive success. Enjoy.
Winter is coming.
I'm not sure if, as you are prepared to meet almost certain doom, if maybe being a little tipsy isn't the way to go into it.
So it's time to join Survivor's Rob Cisternino on post-show recaps as he brings you highlights of the biggest television event of the year.
Other than the dragons, whose job is it to take out the Night King?
Download new episodes of post-show recaps every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. Dragons not included.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
All right, I'm here with Adam Carolla. Hey, Adam.
Good to see you, my friend.
It's so apropos that we're in your studio in Glendale, because this is exactly why I wanted to have you on my podcast, because you just do shit yourself. And it's so great. Like, everything that you've done, I mean, I grew up in L.A., so I've known about you since probably 94 when I listened to KROQ with Kevin and Bean.
Sure, yeah.
And I feel like in just researching you for this talk today, you've made your own way every single move you've made, including making your own movies, writing your own books, stand up, this show, the podcast, the studio you've built. It's fucking great, man.
Well, thank you. It's, you know, it's nice to hear, especially from someone of your ilk, Todd. And I do have a thing, which is I have all my Paul Newman race cars and all that kind of stuff at the other shop. And and I'm going to circle back to what you just said, but I do, once in a while, somebody says on a Saturday, hey, my dad's a big fan, I've got to bring him out and look at some of those old Newman cars or my son or whatever. And whenever I walk them through it on a Saturday and the dad's into it or the son's into it or they're both into it, and then at the end they go, oh, thank you so much for taking the time, I know you're busy and blah, 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 I go, no, no, thank you. I never get to appreciate it because I'm always running past sure. it and on to the next thing and stopping and having you go, boy, isn't this great.
It's amazing.
That must be cool. Does make me sort of stop and appreciate it, because otherwise I'm just off to the next thing minus the appreciation.
Well, let's make this whole podcast that of you okay. just appreciating, because what I'm trying to talk to people about on my podcast all the time and just being a producer is just fucking go do it. Do it yourself. Don't wait, because I feel like so many people come up to me and say, how do you become a producer? How do you become a writer? How do you become an actor? And by the way, you've been doing this. You were a carpenter. You were a boxing instructor. And I want to talk to you about the Kevin and Bean thing. Because did you just cold call the radio station and say, hey, I hear Jimmy, the sports guy, needs a boxing instructor. I can do it. Like, these kind of moments are what really get me going.
I had a weird sort of run up to it, which is I was a carpenter and then I was teaching boxing and I was taught boxing and was a carpenter, and I built the gym Bodies in Motion in Pasadena, and the guy who ran the place just said, well, if you build the gym, then you can teach the morning class for $20 a class.
That was generous of him.
I know.
Hey, build me my thing and you can teach for me.
Yeah, I know. It was a good deal. It was a weird thing.
And
the reason I got in is because I was a carpenter, but I did build the gym in Old Town Pasadena, and I did work the 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. class, and I got $20 a class, and I had a private student or two, and I got $20 a pop, I remember. And then when I was done, I would go off and go do whatever side jobs I had in the carpentry world. By then, I was just kind of working for myself, and I had a list of handfuls of people that knew me and just various carpentry jobs going on. And I never tell this part of the story, but at some point, I was listening to Howard Stern, and Howard Stern was talking about having like Jessica Hahn fight some other trollop who was on his show or whatever
it was. I
think
that's in the movie, actually, in Private Parts.
There was a boxing match or something. And I remember going like, oh, I could call into Stern and train one of them or something. And I tried and it didn't work out. And then shortly thereafter, I was driving my truck and I was delivering an entertainment cabinet to a woman named Marjorie Gross. I think it was Gross or Marjorie Grossman or Marjorie Gross. Anyway, she was a writer for Seinfeld, a Canadian woman. And I was driving over the hill over Laurel Canyon with her entertainment unit in the back of my truck, and I heard Kevin and Bean talking about boxing and a boxing match and blah, blah, blah. And then once again, the call went out. Like, we need trainers. We need equipment. We need a venue. And we need whatever. And I was like, I'm a trainer. I'm a trainer. I was thinking to myself, I didn't have a cell phone. I went over the hill. I went to Marjorie Gross's house. And I was like, can I use your phone? You know? And she was in show business. Like, she wrote for Seinfeld. So I think she kind of got that I wanted to do comedy or something. And I was just calling K-Rock. And, you know, I'd get Frank Murphy, the producer for the morning show. I'd get his answering machine, you know, and I just like, hey, this is a boxing coach, Adam, you know. And I didn't want to train one guy or the other, meaning Jimmy or Michael, the maintenance man. They were both just dudes who were going to box. I wanted to get in on it. And I was just like, I'm a boxing coach. Call me back, you know. And they never called back. And at some point, Kurt Cobain killed himself right around the same time period. And so the whole station was just like, you know, Nirvana this and Kurt Cobain that. And nobody ever called me back. And and yet I would hear them on a daily basis go, could we? And they go like, we need boxing coaches. Oh, on line one, we got a boxing coach. Right. I was like, hey, man, my name's Tom. I'm a boxing coach. And I'd be like, no, no, me, no, me. Like, I'm the boxing coach. I called in 4 days earlier. How come no one's calling me back? And eventually, it kind of dawned on me, like, you must go to K-Rock. You're not going to teach either Jimmy or Michael, the maintenance man, to box because nobody's calling you back. And in each moment that goes by, they're getting closer to picking their two coaches. Maybe they picked one already. I don't know. So I went there.
Which was like down in Culver City at that point, right? And then they do all the shit in the parking lot?
No, it was Burbank.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
That was Culver City for some reason.
Culver City is where they moved eventually. Okay. But this is when they were at a commercial building on Olive and Pass or whatever.
1994.
Like, right in the middle of Burbank.
Right.
And we always called it the Daltz building because it had a restaurant called Daltz in the first it's easy to name a building.
That's right.
Whatever shape it's in, like, that's a flat iron. That thing looks like a goddamn flat iron. What do we call it? Call it the flat iron building. Okay, next. What's that building? It's got a restaurant. What's it called? Daltz. All right, Daltz building. Moving on. So it was the Daltz building, and it's now like a claim jumper or something. And anyway, it's still there, and they're up on like the ninth floor. And I just had I had to teach a class at like 6:30 or something. So I went there at like 6 a.m. and the door was locked, like for the commercial building, and I couldn't get in. And it said like business hours, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. or whatever. And it's like, all right, I'm coming back tomorrow. And I got a guy named Tree, Roundtree, good boxing trainer name, Roundtree.
Yeah, that is good.
Roundtree. And he covered my class and I split. And I went to K-Rock, and now I got into the building. And it's a commercial building. And I got into the building, and I was like, K-Rock's on the ninth floor. And I went up to the ninth floor. And just like any commercial building, the elevator opened, and it's like, oh, there's the K-Rock suite. And the doors were locked. And it's like business hours, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. It's like, oh, it's 7.
Just keeps pushing back.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I got into the building, but no one's at K-Rock. Now, I knew Kevin and Bean were at K-Rock because they're in their studio, and Frank Murphy and Michael, the maintenance man, and Jimmy, the sports guy, and everything. But the receptionist wasn't there. Like, and I should have known because I go, like, you're going to pick up your tickets to Three Non-Blondes. You got to come in business hours between 9 a.m. and where? Come to the front desk. You're right. So the doors are locked. I'm standing by the elevator, and I'm like in this kind of purgatory. I'm like, okay, I came here early, building locked, and I came here later, K-Rock locked. Do I come back tomorrow after 9? And then if I do, I go in the lobby, but that doesn't get me to Kevin and Bean. They're back beyond the door with the buzzer and everything. And then what I do, stand there and tell them there's a boxing trainer. And I was like standing there with all these kind of thoughts kind of running through my head, and a guy who looked like he was there to refill the vending machine or put the water bottle on the cooler or something, kind of the elevator doors open, and he was walking like with purpose toward the back. And I was like, where's this guy going? I started kind of following him, and it turns out in the back there's like a key card door, gets you in the back part of the studio. And he was walking over there with his official whatever. And I was like, oh, are you going in? And he's like, yeah, I'm going in. And I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't want to go in because I felt like I was overstepping my boundaries. But I just said, hey, I'm a boxing coach. They're looking for a boxing coach. So I'm just going to wait out here by the elevators. But when you go in, tell those guys there's a boxing coach. I was just out in the hall. And it's like, okay. And he just went in. And then I just sat out in the hall. And like, I didn't know what was going on. Like, I didn't know if he told anybody. It seemed like a lot of time was going by. He didn't come out and check with me or anything. He was there to refill the copier toner or something. And I just sat there and I sat there. And then at some point, I remember clear as day, I was just standing by the elevators. Like, I didn't, 7:15 in the morning, like, no one's around. Like, I don't know what to do. And at some point, I just see Jimmy just turns a corner. He's like coming down the hall, like commercial office building hall.
This is Jimmy Kimmel, for people who don't know that, and Jimmy the sports guy was at K-Rock in 94.
Yeah, and I'm like, and he's kind of walking up the hall, and he goes, hey, you're the boxing coach? And I go, yeah, I'm the boxing coach. And I kind of had something prepared, like, you know, I'm on the up and up, and I'm a good guy, and you don't have to worry about me bugging you or something. And I didn't know if anyone was coming out or if Jimmy was coming out. I didn't know if he was going to go, we already got a coach, or we got a guy on the phone or whatever. But he just came down, and he's like, you're boxing coach? I'm like, yeah. Where's the gym? I was like, Pasadena. What time you want to meet? I said, what time do you get off work? Like, when are you done? I mean, I know you guys are off the air at 10, but I don't know after that. And he's like, how about noon? I was like, good enough. You know, Old Town Pasadena. Like, I gave him the corner and, like, I'll wait for you in the parking structure. And I literally just waited for him in the park. And he was like, okay, see you then. And he had to turn around and go back into the building. Like, he was working. And I was like, okay. And I just stood out in the parking structure across from Bodies in Motion. I just waited. And then I remember he pulled up in a beat to shit RX-7. Like, it was gold and it had like a Bondo primered fender on it and stuff. And my first thought
gold
was,
RX-7s are tough to get in the I don't think they made a lot of them.
I was like, wow, this is show business? Like, wow. I remember having a thought, like, that's show business, huh? Yeah. I got a Zuzu Trooper. It's like kind of nicer than your RX-7, right. And I'm poor. But that was the beginning.
That's amazing. So your latest endeavor is based on your book, not Taco Bell material, and you have now done your first comedy special, which, you've done yourself, and you can get on chassis.com.
Two S's and a Y for those.
C-H-A-S-S-Y.com. And so when did you want – what inspired you to get into comedy? Like, was it a movie? Was it a stand-up that you saw? What? Because you're obviously naturally very funny. What was the impetus for it?
I am naturally funny, and I was kind of realistic with my sort of self-assessment in the mid-80s, and I was, I don't know, 22, 23, 21 and a half. I don't remember, but I had a job. So my job was like, I dug ditches, I demoed stucco off of buildings and like dragged trash around construction sites. It's real trashy, kind of dirty, just hot and sort of messy and, you know.
And you grew up in North Hollywood.
Yeah. And there was no perks and there was no anything. You just eat lunch sitting on a pile of drywall with a bunch of Mexicans all day. And I always would say, I always joke that every construction site was the same. It was 15 Mexicans and three racists named Mike. But it kind of was that way. It was like a bunch of guys didn't speak English and a bunch of douchey white, super dumb white guys named Mike, you know. And I don't really want to hang out. I want to tell jokes or right. Have a laugh or bust chops or whatever. And anyway, I was just sort of sitting around when I was like 22, the early 20s. And I was like, I live in an apartment in North Hollywood with two other dudes in a one bedroom, like no air, and like sharing a futon and riding a motorcycle or beat up pickup truck. And I just remember going, all right, well, this sucks. Like, this sucks. Like, I like cars. I like architecture. I want to live in a house. I want to build a house. I want to design, you know, I want a car. I want a cool car. I want a race car. I want a sports car. There was no path to get there from where I was. I was making $12 an hour, and there's just nothing. If it rained, you didn't go to work, and you didn't get paid. Like, right. it was a mess. Everything was just a kind of poor, downtrodden mess. My family was very poor and very standoffish and very, like, you're on your own. Like, whatever you do, whatever. Have fun. You get nothing. And so I was just, like, sitting around in my apartment, and I kind of went, well, you're good with your hands and you got a good work ethic and like a strong back. And then, but that doesn't pay that much and it's kind of dirty and a little dangerous. And it really is like, there's no, how are you ever going to do anything with that? And then I was like, I think I'm funny. Like, I got that. So you're good with your hands and you're funny. Okay. That's what we know. You're not a good student. You're not good, you know, with numbers. You wouldn't work well in an accounting agency or, you know, you're not going to be an attorney. You're not going to be a doctor. You're not going to be anything. But you're funny and you're not scared of work and you're good with your hands. So I just remember going, well, what could we do with the funny? How could we get paid with the funny? And then I thought, I can't really think of any way to get paid. for the funny part, but you're 22 and a half. What if by the time you were 30, you were getting paid to do something creative or interesting or something where you're in some air conditioning and like sitting down, right, and not up on your feet on a roof somewhere with a bunch of dudes like scraping asphalt, you know, like what? Maybe you could get a job where they're doing funny greeting cards and you could do like funny Father's Day jokes or something like that. And what would that be like? Just inside and someone's bringing in lunch, you know, ooh, Chinese food. Like that was, those were all like big deals to me. Like you have a parking spot, there's air conditioning where you work and you get a lunch break and stuff. Like, remember having all those kinds of fantasies, not really pie in the sky, just like maybe get a job for some local radio show where you just wrote jokes for the commercials or something. I wasn't having any grandiose thoughts about being on billboards or anything. And so I said, all right, well, I think if you're realistic about your expectations, you're not thinking about being a star or making millions of dollars or anything like that. The goal is, I don't want to make money getting paid by the hour and doing something that involves my back and sweat. I want to get paid like $50,000 a year, and I might take off a week for Christmas time and still get paid.
Right.
Which is a novelty, obviously, in construction or any of those jobs. It was all how many hours did you work, and that's what you get paid for. Christmas, holidays, doesn't matter. So I was like, all right, so what do we do? And I went, well, I guess you got about 8 years to figure this out. And I was like, all right, what's my first move? And I started talking to, like, well, I know Danielle Chaikin. And she's a Jewish friend of mine, and she lives up in the hills, and her dad like composes music, and her mom was like an actress or something. Like, she's not one of my jack-off buddies from the Valley.
Right.
So I'm going to go ask Danielle's mom what she knows about acting or the creative world or who she knows and their creative family. And she's like, you should take a Groundlings class.
Right.
And I was like, okay.
What the hell is that?
What is that?
Just pause for 1 second?
Sure.
Every single person I talk to has one person. And it's not the one person that's like, oh, I know a guy who writes for Seinfeld, or I know Adam Carolla. It's one person where you can go, that person knows that person. Let me just follow this string. And if you're ambitious, and obviously you are, because all of these stories are you just making shit happen on your own. And then for anybody who wants to be in this business or is in this business and is stuck, find the one person where you go, wait a minute, that person at least knows something more than me. Let me reach out to that person. Every person I've talked to that's been successful in this business had like an aunt that knew, I don't know what he does. He thinks he's a sound guy. You know, you don't need to have the perfect guy or the perfect woman to talk to. Just kind of follow that thread, which is what you did.
Yeah, I was like, I know all my buddies, like their dads work at transmission shops and stuff. But Danielle Chaikin, her parents are like sort of in the business, I think.
Right.
I didn't even know what the business was, but they lived in a bigger house and they did something with music publishing or something. And so sure enough, she just said, go take a Groundlings class. And of course, you know, I didn't know anything about sketch, improv, whatever, Groundlings, Melrose, I didn't know anything, but she went, go down here and go, you know, back then there was like no computers or anything. It was just like, go down to the Groundlings, show up, get a pamphlet, you know, someone's phone number's on there, you know, take a beginner's class, pay $275 for beginner's class. And so I did. I didn't have money. I was making 11, 12 bucks an hour. But I was always able to like carve out. I didn't have car insurance. I didn't have medical insurance. I didn't have anything. I wasn't really paying for anything but food and
right.
a one bedroom apartment with three dudes in it. So it was like I could kind of carve. I didn't have a truck payment or buy like beater, Toyota pickup, Nissan for, you know, $900 and fix it myself and blah, blah, blah. So I signed up and I started taking Groundlings classes. And It was pretty clear to me that I was funnier than most people, but I had no experience, and I had no, like, when the teacher would say, "All right, let's move downstage," I'd be like, where are we going? Right. And I got to see people starting to move. I go, "Okay, we're going that way." And yeah. They go, "Stage left, Adam, stage left." And I go, "My left?
I'm moving left
upstage. What's the right direction place? Are we going here?" Right. I didn't know anything. I never took an acting class. And what I'd found, unlike the construction site and many of my buddies, everybody at the Groundlings was highly educated. It just attracts, you know, it's like Conan O'Brien. You know, that's who shows up at the Groundlings, right. You know, like it's a bunch of those guys. And they all had theater backgrounds. They seemed to have theater and education was their background. And my background was football, construction, and now this,
right.
You know, so I didn't know anything, but it was like, I think I'm funnier than these people, but I don't know how any of the rules, like, it was like, I'm more athletically gifted, but I don't know any of the rules of the game.
Right.
But I did get that part where I think I'm a better athlete than these people, but not a better student of the game.
Right.
So I was like, okay, well, you're funny, good. You got that part going for you. And now you have to figure out where you fit in and how it works and how you could get paid. And I did went through the first series, the beginner series at the Groundlings. And, you know, they were right. I was right. They were like, "You're funny, but you don't know what you're doing, you know. And like, have you ever been on stage? You ever taken an acting class? You ever done anything?" And I was like, "No, just football, construction, you know,
here.
And they're like, "Well, we will move you from beginning to intermediate class, but you first got to take an acting class. And when you take an acting class, then you can, once you complete that, then we'll kind of put you in line for the intermediate." And once again, I was just like, "Where's an acting class? I don't know any acting classes." And they're like, "The acting center on Ventura Boulevard, whatever, Stu Radford, whatever, the corner there." And I was like, "Okay." And I just went down there again. And it was like, again, it was like more money I didn't have again. You know, it's like $150 for five classes. And I was like, "Okay." And I just signed up for this acting class. And I couldn't act. And I could barely read the stuff they were giving me, and I was a mess, and you know, I didn't know which direction to face or anything, and I was bad. Like, I mean, I knew I was bad. I knew I was there because I was bad. I knew the Groundlings knew I was bad. I also knew they thought I was funny.
Right.
So I was just like, "Okay, well, what do we got? 8 years? Got 8 years.
Start going.
To figure it out.
Right.
Go be bad at your acting class." And I was bad at my acting class, and then I sort of completed it, and I sort of went back to the Groundlings, and they're like, "Okay, well, promise is a promise. We'll we'll sign you up for the intermediate." But the way the Groundlings worked is they had so long in between intermediate, writing lab, and advance, it could be a number of years. It was probably about 4 years in between by the time you went from beginning to advanced. The classes themselves were 12 weeks or whatever they were, but the time in between the classes could be like 9 months.
Right.
And what they would do is they would throw you other classes. They'd go like, "Mindy Sterling's doing a class at the AIDS church over there," or whatever it is, on the Highland church over there. "It's in the basement. It's Saturdays. She starts at 10 to noon, and you can go do it. It's not a Groundlings class, and you don't get credit for it as a Groundlings class, but I think you can do it for free." Like, they just go, Mindy's running a class, or whoever's running a class, Karen Uramaki or whatever. God, what the hell was her name? Anyway, all these people, they're all like teaching over at the church or the place next to the Cornet Theater Tuesday and Thursday night, and you go over there.
Wow.
And you just go over there and be like, "Hey, I'm here for free because I'm waiting for my next Groundlings thing to open up." And they'd be like, "Okay." And you just go into the drills, you know, just be the same.
So was Mr. Burcham, which you got, created this character, at Kevin and Bean, and it was after you taught Jimmy how to box for his boxing match. Was that the first time you got paid as a comedian? Was that your 8 years? Did you hit your goal of making money in comedy in the 8 years? Were you 30 yet?
I was. I made money when I was probably 28 teaching comedy traffic school for...
That is amazing.
Let us amuse you, which they right. spelled like lettuce, L-E-T-T-U-C-E.
I can remember getting a ticket in Los Angeles, and you would, obviously your first ticket, they let you get traffic school. I can remember when they handed you it. It was, you know, the LAPD one and then, you know, 100 of like yuck comedy schools that you would go. I mean, comedy traffic schools so you'd go so it didn't totally suck the life out of you.
Yeah, I was one of those.
Did you consider that? I did it in within six and a quarter years or 6.5 years?
In my world, it was like you're getting $85 on a Saturday for working at that. Like you go to YMCA in Conejo from like 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and you get like $85. And in my world, in my mind, I was getting paid to not dig ditches okay. or move furniture or clean carpet. Like I was getting paid for my ideas. I didn't delude myself into thinking I was in show business, right. you know? So I was like, but
you're making a living as you, I mean, you were making money doing comedy, which is what the goal for you set for yourself.
I was getting paid to talk and not right. getting paid to move stuff
right.
or sweat.
So how does Mr. Burcham come about?
Well,
which was a character you did in Kevin and Bean, which was this cantankerous contractor slash, you know it all about all things tools and wood and construction, and it was amazing.
Oh, thanks. I had a circling back to let us amuse you.
I'm sorry, remember, I didn't want to cut your letter. No, your traffic school story.
It made me laugh because I was always kind of in my head like super pragmatic and. I remember we had teachers and instructors, and they were like, here's what you do, and here's what you do, and here's a joke, and here's a joke, and here's the joke I do, and this is the jokes I do. This is my airbag routine, you know? And it was never like – it was played kind of flat and dumb and stilted and whatever you'd think it would be. Because I had the mind of somebody who was like a slightly higher level
sure.
comedian, but I was just in a traffic school right. with a bunch of guys.
There's only so many bits you can do.
So I remember them going very clearly. They were like, look, they can go to Sears Traffic School for $18. They come to Let Us Amuse You for $26, and they expect excellence. And they expect for that princely sum of, you know, $6 more or whatever they're paying to come to us. They want to know that they're dealing with world-class comedians. And so I remember just sitting there and they're going, don't be afraid to embellish. Like, don't be afraid to tell your joke. You know, don't be afraid to talk about your career like it's a little. And so they were having – so what they basically said, why don't you go like, well, I just got done opening for the Rolling Stones out on tour. You know, we played mostly soccer stadiums. And it's like – I remember thinking to myself, we're at a Holiday Inn.
Right.
We're in Redlands. It's 8 a.m. It's Sunday.
Right.
How's the career going? How much of this are they going to buy?
It's self-explanatory.
It's really self-explanatory. I'm teaching traffic school.
Right.
It's 7:44 in the morning on Sunday.
Yeah.
Of course, my stand-up career is not going well because there's no f***ing way.
It's literally in the job description.
I'm literally here. How could you possibly be selling this story? And they're always like, don't be afraid to embellish. And I'm like, I'm not saying a fucking word about how great my career is going because here we are.
Right. Have you taken your kids to Universal Studios and gone to the Waterworld show?
No.
Oh, it's the same fucking thing. They come out and they go, you've seen him.
Oh,
it's
like, right.
You're working at a Waterworld show.
At Waterworld.
Come on. If you were really doing stunts for Daredevil,
right.
Die Hard 4.
It's...
you
yes.
would be doing stunts for Die Hard 4.
It's sad. And so I was teaching Jimmy, and Jimmy and I hit it off immediately, and he wasn't doing much back then other than he was a sports guy for Kevin and Bean, but he didn't have a real career going. He was part of a morning show. And he immediately – he loved me. He loved my angle, my perspectives, my sense of humor. He tapped in more than anybody, or certainly first, faster than anybody. He tapped into something where he's like, oh, you have something going on right. that I haven't seen. And I was like, what? Like, I hadn't had any success, and nobody really – I knew I was funny, but no one ever pulled me aside and was like, hey, man, you got it, you know. And Jimmy was that way. Jimmy's like, you got something cooking in your head, and it's different, and it's special, and we need to figure out a way to, like, get you on the air. And I said, oh, yeah, like, yeah, for sure. I would love to do that, because I did meet him – 30 was always the goal, and I literally met him weeks before my 30th birthday, and it was kind of weighing on me, like, I got to do something. And maybe that extra sense of urgency propelled me to wait at the building and try to get into the building and blah, blah, blah. But he said, look, I think you got something, but I'm not the one who gets to decide. Kevin and Bean decide, and they're not really fans of a lot, you know, like comedically, and there's a good chance whatever you do is not going to tickle their fancy, and it's probably going to be a kind of a one and done thing. But he said, I'll give you the number and you call in like Monday morning after the boxing match, and I'm not going to tell them you're the boxing coach, because I don't want them to go, oh, this guy's a boxing coach and now he wants to get on the radio. Like, that sounds a little thirsty to me. Right. And I'm not going to tell him anything. I'm just going to go, here's this guy, he's calling in. And then Jimmy said, but what do you do? What do you do? And I said, I hang and I crack wise and I, like, roll with the punches and I just sort of counter punch and boom, boom, boom. And he's like, well, you can't do that. And I was like, why not? He said, well, that's what Kevin and Bean do. Right. They don't need you, like, sitting in between them, you know, doing that. You gotta come up with a character. And I just went, I don't do characters. I do myself, you know. And he said, well, you better come up with something. And he just went, you know, like, hey, it's Friday. Call in Monday at 8 a.m. and you got the weekend, but come up with something. Oh, come up amazing. With a character. And I was like, I don't do voices and I don't do anything. And I started to, like, okay, all right, let's see character. What, calling into the morning? Oh, I'm the gay florist who reviews movies. You know, like, I was writing notes down. Yeah. Like, who's calling in to Kevin and Bean as the character who then does what? Like, what is the character and what's he do? And I remember always kind of having this thought of just like, well, you got to kind of go for what you know, right? Like, you got to go for what you know. And I was like sitting around and I was like, you know carpentry, that you know that. It's like, okay. So, like, the gay florist thing, it's like, okay, but you're not gay and you're not a florist and I don't know. And then I started thinking, well, all right, so you know carpentry, but now what? And I was like, well, and I was falling back on, like, my Groundlings training in Acme Theater after that. I was like, what would your motivation? What would your characters... Why would your character call Kevin and Bean? So I know about wood. Okay, but why is that a motivating factor for your character to call in Kevin and Bean? And I went, well, I always kind of marveled at how horrible all my shop teachers were in junior high and how Mr. Sapanzi and Mr. Mendez, Mr. Gage, how they're all just colossal assholes. Right. And they're always so angry and, like, everything else. And I was like, well, those guys are kind of funny because I think everyone's had that shitty, mean dude shop teacher when they were in the seventh grade and the guy was a dick, you know. And I thought, oh, well, that'd be funny. Then this guy should be a shop teacher, you know, like an angry junior high shop teacher. And, well, he'll teach wood shop because you know all about wood. And I worked when I played for the Sun Valley Falcons and Pop Warner. There's a guy on my team named Eric Burcham. And I was like, Burcham. Yeah, Burcham's a good name because it sounds like wood.
Right.
But it doesn't seem like over the top in your face, you know. Yeah. So, oh, yeah, my name, Mr. Burcham. And where's he teaching? And I went to Walter Reed at junior high. So I just made – he taught it. Louis Pasteur Middle School in Monrovia, which could exist or could not exist,
sure.
And like anyone who's listening. And he taught wood, and he even later on, I think he taught remedial wood, which doesn't exist, but it sounds good. And he hates his students, and he hates his life, and he hates the school, and he hates everyone who works at the school and everything else. And then I got to the point where it's like, why is he calling Kevin and Bean? Like, in my mind, as a sort of trained groundling graduate, I was like, you got to have motivation. You can't just be calling in. And I think, like, some people would be like, as long as it's funny, it's funny. Like, all is forgiven. But I was like, I wanted a reason for him to call in. And I was like, I'll bet you all of his students listen to Kevin and Bean. They're all K-Rock fans. Their demo would be a bunch of young kids, you know? And he wouldn't listen to Kevin and Bean because he doesn't go for that. But he knows that his kids all listen. And he's injured himself in the garage. He injured himself in the shop over the weekend. He's not coming in Monday morning because he's injured. But he's got some choice words for his kids, and he knows they're all listening.
Right.
So he'd call in at like 7:40, and he'd tell Kevin and Bean, like, clear out. Let me just talk to the kids. And then he'd start yelling at his kids through their clock radio and what they could do and what they couldn't do. And it'd be like, oh, that pansy in the sweater vest, Mr. Ponzi's going to be, you know, subbing for me. Don't listen to that guy, you know. And we're going to – he's going to get out that Duquesne projector. He's going to put on the movie Blood on the Bandsaw. We're going to watch it. And you put your heads on the desk and you wait for the bell. Nobody moves. Like, he would, like, yell at everyone to stay away from his drill index and his Makita poster.
Let me just interject for 1 second, because I hope people who are listening to this understand what a masterclass of storytelling that just was. Because the thing I remember about Mr. Burcham was the specificity of the comedy. And all of the thing you just said, how you just walked us through that story of how you came up with that, is what every creative person should do when they're trying to write a script, tell a story, anything. The thought that you had into putting into that character, plus you had a timeline, which is great, you had a deadline, that putting into that character, having the thoughtfulness to go, well, what do I know, which is hugely important, because that's the thing you used to say, and I can't do it. You would say a specific tool with a gauge of a saw, and it was so minute. The detail was so specific that it just made it so authentic and amazing. And then to take the time to say, well, that would be funny, but the motivation – I mean, that's a master storytelling class, man. And that's the thing about your books and your podcast and your radio show that you did, and even the Hammer, and you know, and Road Hard, they're all from your real life, some version of your real life, and it all comes from a truly authentic place. So I was fascinated to hear the whole process of how that came about, because nobody could have just bullshitted their way through that. You knew so much about the tools of the trade and the way that it all was held together that's what felt authentic, and I think that's why your show, The Adam Carolla Show, is so massive, is you always just speak from your own knowledge and your heart, and you're obviously very funny and intelligent.
Well, thank you. For me, it was like, I don't want to say things that don't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to, I can't motivate myself. Things have to live in some environment that have some gravity and an up and a down and everything else. And it wasn't enough that I just call up and be funny. I like, not for the audience, but for me, I needed a reason why I was calling up, you know? And I can't quite explain why I needed that, but it's like, in order to propel my words, I don't want to sing, you know, it's like, I don't know, it's like when the Beatles would come up with a big hit, like Love Me Do, and then at some point they'd go, record it in German. And they'd go like, I don't know any of these words. I know, just read them.
Right.
You know, like, okay, it still kind of sounds like the same song, but it's in German.
Right.
But the Beatles don't know what the words mean, but you can still move some copies. My thing is like, I wanted to know what the words meant. I didn't want to do a phonetic version of what I was trying to do. Otherwise, I wouldn't feel motivated. But also, it wouldn't have legs. Like, I also kind of realized, like, this is a marathon. This isn't a sprint. And if you did something that was super funny, it'd come around to the next Monday, and where would you be? You know, like, I needed this guy's world to kind of expand and unfold, and it needed to come from some place that involved reality. And like, then I could start weaving in students and teachers and school events and in my home life. And, you know, I'd call up like all like broken up, like one day, like, what's the matter, Mr. Bird? Sawbuck, he's gone. You know, like, what happened? Sawbuck, my dog, Sawbuck, he, that ranchero up on blocks in the driveway, and it's hot, and he used to sleep under that. And I had a little too much, I don't know, the DayQuil or Robitussin. Anyway, I came back, and I hit the driveway with a little extra momentum, and I hit the car, and the car fell off the blocks, and it crushed Sawbuck. And then I'd go, like, I know I shouldn't blame myself, but I can't help it. I know I feel like it was partially my fault. And they go, it's all your fault, Mr. Bertram. You hit the car, and I can't help blaming myself. And so Sawbuck would be dead, and Higginstaller's like my prize student. And I'd be like, everyone's got their head down on the desk and no one can get near my drill index or anything. And then I'd be like, Brad Higginstaller, like you, my friend, you have a gift. This man can shape wood. This kid reminds me of a young me. And I'd start talking to him like, okay, Brad, you're allowed to work the lathe and the press. And we've been working on the cigar box for your grandfather. Been thinking about it over the weekend. I don't want to go with a dado or a dovetail joint. I think we'll just go with a rabbit joint. And you can go ahead and use my joiner if you want. But when you set up the dado, set up on the contractor saw, and I just talk him right all the way through this whole stupid thing. And it became like super vivid.
Yeah.
And I could like see everybody.
I can
in my
see it.
Head,
just you telling that story right there of your dog being hit. Oh, I can see that house in Monrovia. I can see the El Camino up on blocks. I can see you hitting. I mean, that's the thing that's so amazing about all your storytelling. And so walk me through. Now you have this huge empire. When you do your show and when you write your books, and now that you've done this big stand-up special, same thing? I mean, you're speaking on your book, obviously, not Taco Bell material, is all from your life. I haven't seen your special yet. Is your stand-up the same? Are you still drawing from your own experiences?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combo of stuff that I think is funny, stuff that's from my life, stuff that hopefully is a kind of universal human kind of reaction to things. It's all kind of based in some truth or some desire or some, again, the part about comedy that was always problematic or vexing or would be a stumbling point for me is like, if somebody would say, my girlfriend just broke up with me and, boy, I'm really whatever. And it's like, they didn't just break up or they're happily married or whatever it is. Like, it's a part of comedy, but it never felt right to me. Like, right. Like if I do a bit on, dentistry and oral surgery, it's because I had oral surgery like 2 months ago,
right,
you know, or if I'm talking about going in and doing this or doing that or something my kid did or something my wife did or, you know, whatever, even if it's trite stuff like airplane travel or whatever.
Right.
It's got to be stuff that's happened to me or stuff that exists,
right,
or stuff that I've experienced. It just, otherwise it feels like empty calories.
It's got to be authentic.
Even back in the day when you'd hear about guys like, well, this guy's a joke writer for Bob Hope, or this guy's a joke writer, he's got a team of joke writers. I'd be like, why? What do you mean joke writers?
Right.
Like, why?
Right.
What'd you do with a joke writer? Why would you have a joke writer? And I get it, working on Kimmel and doing late night shows and stuff like that. Like at a certain point, it becomes like a joke mill and you have factory, and it's like you need a staff and you need to blah, blah, blah. Like I get that. But when it comes to like jokes, or buying jokes off of comedians or stealing jokes from comedians, it feels so counter everything to me. It just feels, I have this fantasy that my nightmare is like, I steal a joke or I buy a joke from somebody and I start to tell it and someone just screams, that's someone else's joke, like in the middle of it. I would never do it. I would never.
Right.
It feels like the opposite of comedy.
Right. Well, so there's two questions I always ask. One, if you were to give advice to somebody that is wanting to get into the business or is in the business and really wanting to change or just do something really creative to be in this business, not necessarily to be a producer, because you produce all your own stuff. You produce your own movies, you produce your television, radio, which is probably the answer to the question, is just go out and do it. But what advice would you have creatively for people to have that authenticity and for people to have that, you know, the creative bent that you have and the productivity that you have? What advice would you have for people?
Well, first I would say, let's make sure you have a voice. You may not have a voice. Like, you may not. You may not have things people want to hear. I don't really have a song in me that I need to share with anybody. I love music, and there's nothing I'd love more than being a great musician and being in a big rock and roll band or anything. But I don't have a song in me.
Right.
So I'll leave that up to the Foo Fighters. I don't have it. So first things first, like, just because you've decided that would be a cool thing to do, to star in a movie or do stand up or write a song or be in a rock and roll band or whatever, let's make sure you have something to offer that we couldn't find somewhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, if I can go on to Netflix and find five other examples of what you have to offer, maybe we don't need you. If it's a story that you would like to tell, let's first make sure people will benefit from this story in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't have to be all laughs. Could be people going, "Geez, I never thought about that," or "That's true," or I should change my behavior based on that story. So, but let's figure out what you have to say. I mean, let's be honest. Do you have something to say? Right. And if the answer is yes, then you've cleared the first hurdle. Like, okay, I've honestly assessed myself. I have things I want to say, and I believe society would benefit from hearing that. Now, how do I get to the most sort of authentic version of what I have to say, the stuff that's been not stepped on with baby laxative and talcum powder, like the pure Bolivian shale of what I have to say? And it's easy, and I'm not there either. It's easy to get up and do stand up and get sort of sucked off into a cheap laugh or an easy laugh or something, you know, oh, that's an easy one. Like, they're going to laugh at this. It's just a rhythm of it, or just the way the words sound together. It'll always get a laugh. There's a cadence, you know, and it gets really easy to kind of go, I'll just go slide over there and kind of do that. Then you become like a politician sort of telling, you know, you got a bunch of 23-year-olds, and you're like, I'm going to get rid of college debt, and they all start cheering, and you go, that feels pretty good.
Right, exactly.
How about free pizza on Fridays?
Right.
Like, okay, all right. Free money, and everyone starts cheering. It's like, it gets pretty easy, but are you going to get it done, and what's the plan? And or maybe it's just easier to have that instant gratification. And so think about what it is. Like, what do you want to say? What's different about what you want to say? Why in a sea of storytellers is there room for you? And then how are we going to go about that process? And the process is, you don't even know what you want to say because you haven't said it. So start keeping a steno pad in front of you and jotting down ideas, jokes. Take that, bring it up onto a stage, start sharing that, seeing what people's reaction are to the words and the stories, and come back the next day and say it again, but this time shuffle the deck a little and emphasize this and figure out. And you know, Jimmy Kimmel's a guy who has no qualms about saying it's better this way. It's stronger when you go this and then that. This is the way. This is weak. That's no good. This is a great idea. Get around people that aren't scared to say, this isn't your best work. I prefer this. Or you're stronger when you're focusing on that. I mean, it's humbling.
Yeah. And hard work.
And it can be hard work. But if you internalize it, and not in a negative way, let it in and go, okay, I hear what you're saying, and I'm going to try to focus on that. I'm going to try to adjust that. If you can do that and you can meet a lot of repetition, then you can get really good at saying something. Part B is, do people want to pay to hear it? And that is not really answerable.
Until you do
but
it.
But we do know the better you are telling the story, the greater the chance that someone will cut you a check.
That's amazing advice. And then lastly, a moment in your career where you knew you were hitting that, where you were like, I usually say best day on set. But if just in just if anything you can remember, like being on stage or just being on a show or on your radio show where you're like, man, I'm in the groove right now.
I had a moment just sticking with the old days and Kevin and Bean, maybe in the first year or so. I started up in April or something, and at some point they did like the acoustic Christmas or whatever. And, you know, there was no Twitter, or no internet per se. So you just get talking to Mike, getting your Zuzu Trooper and go to work, go home. I wasn't really getting paid or anything. Really know what was going on outside of the studio. You know, I'd run in some people. Hey, Mr. Birch, it was funny, you know, but I didn't run. And I think it was Kevin and Bean. And I think it was like at the, amphitheater, Universal Amphitheater, whatever they call it, Gibson Amphitheater now or something. And I remember it was sort of like, we're going to introduce Kevin and Bean. We're going to bring out, hey, it's Kevin and Bean. And it's Jimmy the Sports Guy. And it's Lightning and producer Frank Murphy or whatever. And it was like a little like, should we bring out Mr. Burcham? Like, I mean, he's not a 55-year-old shop teacher. He's a 30-year-old Italian guy. Like, right. He's not fat or didn't have gray hair or anything. But they were like, yeah, let's bring out Mr. Burcham. You know what I mean? And they brought out, like, you know, Michael Maine's man, Jimmy the Sports Guy, whatever. And at some point, they're like, and Mr. Burcham, you know? And it's like 9,000 people went nuts.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was like, on stage and there's 9,000 people like at an amphitheater just going
that's awesome.
Crazy. And I remember like going like, wow. And then I was like, sorry, Jimmy. I know you've been with Station for a few years.
I got this one, bud.
But he paid me back.
Well, man, thank you so much for doing this, Adam. You're really honestly an inspiration, man. Just the fact that how you just, get it done, roll up your sleeves and do it. And that's a hugely inspirational to me. Seriously.
Well, I'm going out tonight to do comedy for free because part of my New Year's resolution was to go out and do comedy at least once a week or twice a week and just work out and do it for free. So you're never too old to learn.
I agree. You're always learning. That's why I'm doing this. I'm not
right.
I'm not making money like you are. I'm just doing it because I really want to learn and talk to people like you and hear these stories. And so your special is Not Taco Bell Material on Chassis, chassy.com, man. Everybody take a gander.
iTunes and Amazon, all that.
Right
well.
On. Thank you.
Thanks, Doc.
Right.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, this is Jordan Harbinger, host of the not-so-creatively titled Jordan Harbinger Show. We dig into the superpowers of the world's most interesting thinkers, and then we deliver them to you right into your ears. It's more than just a way to get inspired, and I get it. We're not all superheroes. That's why we give you their blueprint and include worksheets for every episode, as well as answer your listener questions so you can live what you listen. Listen free to the Jordan Harbinger Show, available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.